Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike. Do you have a guilty pleasure?
Oh, I have many, truth be told.
Okay.
Onion rings. I cannot resist a good onion ring.
This week, our guest is Ruth Reichel. Her name became synonymous with restaurant criticism during her six-year tenure at the New York Times. From there, she became the editor-in-chief of Gourmet magazine for 10 years before its untimely demise in 2009. Ruth is the author of 7 books, including 4 memoirs, a novel, 2 cookbooks, and most recently, My Kitchen Year, which detailed the year she spent recovering from Gourmet's shockingly sudden demise. Welcome to Special Sauce, Ruth Reichel. I remember when you got the gig at Gourmet, you came to my house for a party, and you said to me, I'll never forget this, I don't really know what I'm going to do. I've never really had a job like this before. Talk a little bit about what that transition was like.
My first few months there were the scariest time of my life. I mean, well, first of all, I'm so stupid. I mean, I know nothing about management or business. So when I negotiated the deal with Condé Nast, I said, you know, I want to give the New York Times 2 months notice, and then I want a month off. So it was announced in January, and I had agreed to start in May. And after the announcement was made, this is all very well orchestrated how the announcement would be made. So the announcement was made on like January 25th. And Cy Newhouse said to me, would you come speak to the staff? And I said, well, I don't want to speak to the staff. I'm not going to show up until May. And he said, well, you know, this is going to be news and I think you really need to go speak to the staff. And I went to speak to the staff and they're all looking at me in terror. There's 65 people standing there terrified, and I suddenly realize that there is no way I can say bye, see you in 3 months. So for my first, I mean, I worked 2 jobs. I mean, they were all just looking at me and I didn't know what to say. And I said, well, I'm still the restaurant critic of the New York Times until April, but I'll be coming here too.
Yeah.
And then I started showing up there and I didn't have a clue what to do.
But you figured it out.
I did a few things that turned out to be really smart. And one was when I got the job, I said, I will take this job if I can bring Laurie Ochoa and Jonathan Gold with me.
Right.
And Laurie and I had worked together, like we sort of joined at the hip. And
right. Laurie Ochoa is a veteran editor, a great editor in Los Angeles at the LA Times, and then you brought her to Gourmet, and now she's
at the LA Times.
Yeah.
She's the entertainment editor
right
now.
And Jonathan, of course, won the Pulitzer Prize for restaurant criticism. So you were like, okay, this is a package deal.
This is a package deal. Laurie and I know how to do this together. I'm not sure I know how to do it by myself. So that was really important. And then when I got there, and I didn't know anything about business, and I quickly said, you know, you really need to get me someone, a managing editor. And so they brought in a veteran, wonderful
managing
editor who
kept the trains running on time.
And also turned out to be the greatest guy and creative, and
right.
I couldn't have done it without Larry either. And then, you know, gradually you form a team.
And that's Larry.
Larry Carroll.
Got it.
Who just, you know, I mean, Larry can do, you know, the work of 3 people in half the time that
right
one person normally does it.
So you had this amazing run at Gourmet, realizing what you didn't know and bringing people on who could help you. And it's really the same thing with me with Serious Eats. It's like I'd never developed a recipe, but when you've discover somebody like Kenji Lopez-Ald, and then you say, well, why don't you write a food science column? And then he comes up with the food lab, and then it's like, I'm the genius? You know, it's like, you know, I'm not the genius.
No, I mean, there is no doubt in my mind that the secret to good management is you hire people who are smarter than you are, and your job is running interference for them.
Yes.
I mean, you know, I got so lucky with my art directors. I mean, first I had Diana LaGuardia, and then I had the brilliant Richard Ferretti.
Yes, I remember. I met Richard.
And, you know, I would never try and tell them what to do.
Yeah.
I mean, they're the people who know what they're doing. And, you know, I'm a great boss for people who are self-starters. I'm a terrible boss for someone
who needs a micromanager.
Yes, because I'm just go figure. I mean, my idea is not that you fill a job, but you find really great people and then you figure out what their job should be.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sort of, okay, I'm just going to find the best people I can and give them the runway they need to do what they're going to do. And it's really worked out. I mean, you obviously make some mistakes, but you just hope you're right far more often than you're wrong.
And you do make mistakes. There's no question. And they're painful and horrible. I mean, the one thing I was very lucky with at Gourmet was the kitchen. I had Zan Stewart, who had been there for 35 years. And, I mean, I never had to think about the kitchen. The kitchen just it worked beautifully.
So you had this amazing run at Gourmet. And then I remember reading about it. And the demise was so sudden.
Well, you know, I've been writing this because I've just turned in that memoir. And I kept notes on it at the time. And I really thought, I mean, things had been bad. There's no question. I mean, the recession hit us really hard. It hit every magazine hard, but it hit because of the ad strategy of Gourmet, which was based on luxury goods. It hit us especially hard. But things were turning around. I mean, we had this great deal with American Airlines who sponsored our TV show, Adventures with Ruth. That was about to start. The second cookbook had just come out, and the reviews were stellar, and it was clear it was going to be a bestseller. And we had an offer that if you bought the cookbook, you'd get a free subscription to Gourmet for a year. We had created pop-up cookie shops at Macy's, so we were going to make these Christmas cookies, which every year, and Macy's had bought five covers for every issue would have five covers, each with a different cookie on it, with an ad on the back.
Right.
So the revenue for that was enormous. And then we were doing these pop-up cookie shops with the best of the cookies that you could buy, with a piece going to charity. So after this like slump, suddenly things really looked good, and I went off on book tour thinking, oh, yeah, at last, things have turned around. And then I get this call, come back to New York. In the middle of the book tour, I was in Seattle, and I got a call saying, you have to come back to New York. And I said, you want to give me a hint? And no, just come back. You have to be here. And I thought I was going to get fired.
Right.
I mean, it never crossed my mind.
You knew nothing good was going to happen.
No, it was going to be bad.
Right.
But I thought, okay, I mean, you know going into those jobs that at some point you're going to get fired.
And right.
So I thought, all right, you know, I'm going to get fired, and it's finally come. And I never in a million years imagined that Condé Nast would close Gourmet. I just didn't, and I have no idea why.
And so they just gathered the whole staff, or did they tell you first?
They gathered the staff and said, it's over.
Just like that?
Yeah.
Like out of the blue?
It's over.
Yeah. No warning, no
nothing.
Foreshadowing? Or
No. And the December issue was at the printer. And, you know, somebody said, what about the December issue? And so I said, there is no December issue. It's over.
God. I know for me, you know, Serious Eats became a family, and it's different. Condé Nast is obviously a big corporation, but I think probably for people like you, even though it's owned by a big company, they do become sort of de facto families.
Oh, no, and Condé Nast, I mean, one of the great things about the way Cy ran Condé Nast when I was there is each magazine was like its own movie studio. We're not micromanaged. We had almost no contact with corporate people. And you know, my secretary had been there for more than 30 years. I would say half of the staff had been there at least 15 years. I mean, it was a very tight group of people.
Right.
I mean, so tight that it's now 7 years, and we still have reunion dinners and are in constant contact with each other.
But that must have made it all the more devastating.
It was. It was, I mean, for me personally, and that's what I wrote about in my kitchen here, is I felt guilty. You know, 65 people got fired on my watch. And this magazine existed for almost 70 years.
Right.
It ended on my watch. And how could I have been so stupid? Why didn't I see it coming? Why didn't I protect people's jobs? What could I have done differently? I don't know, but I still feel like, you know, if I had been smarter,
sure,
they would not have closed the magazine.
Right, right. Even though it's probably not true, but I could understand why you felt that way, because you have a conscience and there were 65 people out of work.
Yeah. I don't know if they're going to let me title the book this, but I was having dinner with Richard about a year ago, Richard Ferretti, my former art director, who is now... he's gone on to much bigger jobs. And, you know, he just looked at me and he said, you know, Ruth, that was the last fun job.
That's great. That's great. I don't ever take that for granted, you know, especially with Serious Eats. It's like Serious Eats, through all its ups and downs and trying to keep it afloat and then having a good outcome, was a fun job.
Yeah.
And still is a fun job, but there's a certain kind of fun that you can't get anywhere else, you know, when you do something that's so close to your own bone.
And so collaborative.
Right.
I mean, the excitement of, I mean, I just remember this feeling of having a meeting and we would decide, okay, we're going to do a Paris issue. And we would have a meeting and people would throw out crazy ideas and we would all get very excited about them. And I would, you know, it would take us about a year to form a magazine, a special issue like that. And I remember leaving every meeting and thinking, I wonder what this issue is really going to be like. Because everybody takes it and makes it richer and better. And you watch it grow and become its own thing.
Yeah, exactly. Become a thing that's actually, it may not be the thing that you imagined in your own mind.
Exactly. And this feeling of it's ours. And that to me is so important. I mean, I know that there are editors who, probably most editors, who if they don't like something, it doesn't go in the magazine. And I felt it was more important for every editor to feel like they had an investment in the magazine. And if they could make a case for a piece that I hated, it would go in.
Right.
You know, I mean, if it really mattered to Doc or Nanette or Jocelyn, and they said, you know, you're really making a mistake now. Okay.
Doc Willoughby was one of your chief lieutenants, who's now at Cooks Illustrated, and Jocelyn. I don't even know.
Jocelyn Zuckerman, a brilliant editor who has gone on to many. She went out to On Earth. She's a wonderful editor and a very dedicated person about issues of social justice and the environment.
So the magazine closes just at the moment that the digital food media revolution had begun to take hold.
I fought so hard to have a gourmet.com almost from the time that I got there. I mean, I hated the notion of Epicurious, that, you know, all our content going to Epicurious.
Right. And that was always the internal battles at Condé Nast, right?
Where right, the, yes. Cy wanted these dedicated sites
right.
that would scoop up all the fashion, all the...
Right, and then the purpose of gourmet.com to him was just to sell magazine subscriptions.
Exactly. And I just kept fighting for it, and we did finally, and in fact, one of the other good things that happened in that last year at ASME, we got nominated for an ASME, which is the big magazine awards, for gourmet.com, and gourmet.com was growing and people were liking it, and I saw it as a really important, I mean, I saw then that you cannot fight the moving image. You just can't. And it was clear to me that screens were going to take over. And it didn't matter if it was your television screen, your tablet, your phone, but that screens were going to be the future and that we needed to build as robust a website as possible. And it was really hard at Condé Nast.
And did you regard the coming digital media revolution as a positive or just as an inevitability?
You know, my father was a book designer. So he started his career in 1926 in this country and worked until he died in 1980. I once gave him a subscription to a magazine called Fine Print that does letterpress. And he looked at it and he said to me, "Why would you give me this? I'm not a Luddite." He said, "The computer is the most exciting thing that has ever happened to book designers ever. It's going to revolutionize." So I sort of felt, I mean, my father's voice is in the back of my head all the time thinking, you can decry technological developments, but you can also say, what are they going to do to make the content that we have more exciting and better?
Yes, I agree. It's funny. I was once asked to come judge the final projects of the became the Columbia Publishing course. And so they brought me there and with a bunch of people in different aspects of the media. And the assignment was for a magazine launch. And I said, and my wife said, "This is why you're never going to be invited back to do this." I said, "Look, I read everything. They sent me the four they wanted me to judge." And then I said, "Isn't this like asking people to develop a business plan for a blacksmith shop?" And so she said, "Yeah, and you wonder why they've never invited you back." But it's to the same point that your father was making, really.
Yes. I mean, look at the positive things about technological developments. And, you know, the idea that you can make magazines dance and do things that they've never done. I mean, it's really exciting. And with cooking, I mean, the idea that you can show people how to make things, that you don't have to use these static pictures.
Absolutely. Because you've embraced it, you know, obviously with all the tweeting and I think in many other ways, whereas many of your contemporaries didn't embrace it. You know, they were like, what happened to the world we inhabited?
It is a different world. And there are some troubling things, but I don't think for magazines. I mean, I worry about kids who, you know, what is it doing to their brains that
right.
they're on, you know,
right, they're looking at little screens for 20 hours a day or
yeah.
whatever. Yeah.
And, you know, I worry that we haven't controlled it enough for children, and I worry at dinner tables. I look around restaurants and people aren't talking to each other.
Yeah.
They're on their screens. But in terms of what we do, I think it's only positive.
Yeah. And what advice would you give a young person who wanted to be in food media?
Specialize in something. Know more about some topic than anybody else.
Right. Yeah, you know what's funny about that is that was probably as true when I started out. Everyone was like, wow, you know a lot about pizza. You know, it was just like that was my passion. And it turned out that it was a position I could occupy that nobody else occupied. And what you're saying is the same thing. And the only thing I would add is learn to tell stories in as many media as you can. You know, because
that's great advice.
Because that's what I always say. I was like, you know, you have to learn, obviously, to tell stories with the written word, but you should know your way around a camera. You should know your way around video. You should know your way around audio storytelling, because it's all becoming one, to your point. There is no difference. You know, so when somebody like Kenji Lopez-Alt does a piece for Serious Eats, now he's doing a video. He's taking all his own photos. He's doing things that we didn't have to do.
Yeah, I mean, when I worked at, you know, after Gourmet, I went to work at Gilt Taste in this new experiment
right.
in journalism. And I learned so much from these kids that I was working with because the good ones saw every problem as an opportunity.
Absolutely.
And, you know, we had a lot of money, and then as the money went away, we first were hiring photographers, and then when we couldn't afford to hire photographers anymore, two of them said, "We're going to go take a photography course, and we're going to do all the photographs. This is great."
Right. Right. It's true. And that's the reality of digital media now. So you can't fight it because you can't just say, I'm a writer. You know, it's like, no, you're actually not. You're a storyteller, but that's different than being a writer.
Yes.
It incorporates being a writer, but it's not the only thing you have to be able to do.
And I would say the other thing I would say to people in the food media, the thing that worries me about is like one of the things with the demise of gourmet is we actually had the money to send people out to do investigative reporting in food. And we need it more than ever.
I agree.
There are fewer and fewer outlets.
I agree with that 100%. And it's obviously not true about just about food, but it's about politics. It's about sexual slave trade. It could be about anything that's really important because the internet in general does not reward that kind of and doesn't have the resources to devote to that kind of thing.
Exactly. Our democracy depends on it, though. It really depends on the press acting as a watchdog.
Yeah.
And, Ted Genoways, who's doing such wonderful work in The Atlantic on food issues, and I don't know him. I've never met him, but I love his work. And I tweeted him and said he wrote this fantastic piece. And I said, you make me wish I had a magazine so I could send you out. And he said, I wish there were more New York editors who were interested in what's going on in the farms in the Midwest.
Yeah. Oh, it's true. All right. So now it's time for the special sauce, All You Can Answer Buffet. And this is something we do. We torture everybody.
Uh-oh.
But it's fun.
Okay.
It's fun. And
fun for you.
You can think about your answers. We don't have a clock or any song that you have to listen to while you think about your answers. So what's in your desert island fridge?
Eggs, lemons, Parmesan cheese, bacon, capers, butter. I don't put bread in the fridge, but I don't want to be without bread.
Okay.
Fish sauce, soy sauce, probably miso. I can go on.
Right. But there's a unifying umami element here.
Yes. You can if you have fermented things, you can make any food taste good.
Yeah, it's true. So who's at your last supper? No family allowed, people living or dead, artists, poets, it can be anybody. It's a table for six, you're one.
A table for six, I'm one. Well, the first person is the first Queen Elizabeth, who I am so interested in.
Really?
This woman. I mean, she was the most powerful woman in like 1,000 years. And she was really smart, and I would like her to meet Cleopatra.
Okay, so there's two.
There's two right there.
I like this. The first, Queen Elizabeth, Cleopatra, and you. All right, you got three more.
There's an author who's now no longer living, but whose work I love. She's a historian and novelist named Dorothy Dunnett. I would put her at the table because, one, she could speak to both of them in a really interesting way.
All right.
I think I'm going to have you come to the table,
too.
Oh,
I like this.
You are wonderful company.
All right. You've got one more.
So I can't have any family there, right?
No, you can't have any family because when we first asked this question, everyone just gave their family. And then we realized we have to be more provocative than that.
Right. Well, we need another man for you.
All right.
I'm thinking maybe Bill Clinton, because he's also great company.
Yeah, and he's, we wouldn't even ask him to do a lot of splaining that he has to do.
He is,
I don't know if you've ever met him. I've only met him for 5 minutes. The most charismatic person I've ever met in my entire life. There is a magnetic force field that draws you to him. I have never, ever experienced that.
I met him once very briefly because Romulo, our photographer, did a book with Hillary on the White House something or other.
Right.
And we flew up. And so I talked to him for a minute maybe in a line. But it was like I was the only person in the room. Oh, and if I can have one other person.
Yes.
Mike Nichols. I love Mike Nichols.
Oh, me too.
Miss him. And he's another one. Best company of anyone.
Mike Nichols. You know that I once got a phone call. This is Mike Nichols' assistant. This is when we still had answering machines. Could you call Mike's office? And I thought it was a phony phone call, right? And so I called him. And then he is that hold on for Mike. And Mike gets on the phone. He goes, Ed Levine. I say, yes. He says, I love your writing. You have perfect food pitch. And what are we going to do about the demise of Georgie's Donuts? Isn't that awesome? Georgie's, for those of you who don't know, is this legendary donut store on 125th Street in Harlem that I wrote about in the first New York Eats in 1991. And he literally said, if it takes money, because they were going to close, I will keep it going. And I will raise money. I mean, he was totally serious about this.
Oh, I absolutely believe it. He loved to eat. And he called me when I was at the New York Times and said, you know, basically, one, meet me. And so I took him and Diane out to dinner a lot.
Yeah.
And
yeah, he was an incredible rock on tour, and he was great company.
Bright, yeah. And warm and wonderful.
Mike Nichols, of course, is this incredible, was this incredible creative force in movies and theater and improv. He directed The Graduate, among many other movies, directed so many plays, was in a famous improv duo with Elaine May.
And his last wife was Diane Sawyer.
Right, who was the ABC News anchor and very powerful figure in broadcast news. So what are you eating? What are we eating now that I'm here? What are we eating at the Last Supper?
Oh, well.
Three courses.
Well, you know, part of what's exciting about having these two women is, so we've got this woman from Egypt, from way long ago Egypt, and we've got Queen Elizabeth before the Columbian Exchange. So there are all these exciting things that these people have never tasted. And so part of it is we want to give them new world foods that will be totally new to them, like tomatoes. So probably we start with a very simple tomato salad of just perfect tomatoes. But
olive oil, salt, maybe a basil, maybe not.
Maybe a little bit of basil. Really good olive oil, really good vinegar.
Okay.
And just, you know, blow them away with this lovely,
I like that,
tomato salad. And well, you have to give them peanut butter because I wouldn't have had peanuts either.
I don't know how you're going to work that into a main course.
No, not in a main course.
Sorry.
Maybe have some peanuts on the table, just because you want them to be excited by new flavors that they've never had before.
Right. Okay.
For a main course, I don't know how Cleopatra would have liked this, but I'm thinking for Queen Elizabeth, a really great aged steak, grilled, which would taste like nothing.
A bone and ribeye.
That she would have had with a baked potato, because potatoes would be new.
Yeah. I love the fact that you're introducing Cleopatra and Queen Elizabeth, and that your interest is in really getting them to explore things that they never would have tried otherwise.
Absolutely. I mean,
says a lot about your worldview.
But that's exciting, right?
I mean,
here are some things you've never tasted before. Try them.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. I like that.
For dessert, well, of course, we're going to give them chocolate.
Right.
Because chocolate would be totally new to them. So, you know, the flourless chocolate cake with a little bit of whipped cream on it.
I like this. I'm there. I am so there. So what's your guilty pleasure? Do you have a guilty pleasure?
Oh, I have many.
So
truth
just
be told,
okay.
Onion rings. I cannot resist a good onion ring.
Even bad onion rings aren't that.
I mean, even.
But good onion rings are hard to find. But when you find them, they are transcendent.
They are fantastic, and they are, you know, they're totally a guilty pleasure.
No, I agree. So, what do you cook when there's nothing in the house to eat?
Well, I always have the makings of spaghetti carbonara. So in my house, there is always dry pasta, bacon, and eggs, and Parmesan. But if you mean there's none of that...
No, could be that. That's good. Yeah, those are essentials. That's fine. And this may be a little bit redundant with who's at your Last Supper, but is there a person that you could imagine loving having a one-on-one lunch with just to see how their mind works? Just the idea of an intense one-on-one lunch.
Bob Dylan. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. You know.
And even if he didn't say much, you'd be okay with that.
Yes, but I'm hoping he would talk.
He'd open up?
I'm hoping he would talk. I mean, I imagine that in a one-on-one situation, he probably would talk. And he's been, you know, such an important figure in my life. I'll tell you, and this isn't another dead person, but I just saw the Max Beckman show this morning. It opened at the Met, and I'm kind of in love with Beckman. I would love to sit down with him, too.
That's great. I like that. Bob Dylan and Max Beckman. Well, this has been awesome. Thank you, Ruth Reichel, for sharing your special sauce with us. We can't wait for the gourmet memoir to come out. There's the book about your reaction to gourmet. What's it called?
My Kitchen Year.
And so there are many ways for us all to enjoy the fruits of Ruth's endeavor. So thank you really for being on Special
Sauce. I feel
like
I could just talk to you forever. We could just sort of sit in here and, you know, keep going for a few hours.
Yeah, this has been great. So thank you, and we'll see you next time, Series Eaters.